Good evening. Welcome to the Jamie Glazoff Show. Our focus this evening, Obama, the anti-Israel president. That is the title of the new blockbuster video produced by the David Horowitz Freedom Center. You can watch this video, Obama, the anti-Israel president, at frontpagemag.com. That's our website. You go to frontpagemag.com and look at the top right-hand corner, and you can watch this new video. It documents how Barack Obama, the first president of the United States that has broken a U.S. tradition, and instead of standing close by our ally in the Middle East, he is treating our ally as an enemy and treating our enemies in the Middle East as friends. We are honored and privileged to have a very special guest with us this evening, David Goldman, the author of the new critically acclaimed book, How Civilizations Die and Why Islam is Dying Too. It is a privilege to be graced by his presence. David Goldman, welcome to the program.
Oh, Jimmy, thank you so much for that kind introduction. I appreciate it.
And you were on a couple of weeks ago, and you were a great hit. We were discussing your book, and we'll discuss your book a little bit more during this hour. David, let us begin with this. I think very simply, and let's just begin in general, what did you think of the video, Obama, the anti-Israel president?
Well, I think that the Horowitz Center has done an enormous public service by exposing the mendacity of this administration, which, of course, in the context of the elections, has tried to represent itself as in continuity with the long-standing American alliance with Israel, but in fact has done everything possible to sandbag Israel. I think the video really drilled in on a critical aspect of Obama's character, which is unique in the history of the American presidency. Obama is the child of a Muslim and the stepchild of a Muslim, and the son of a mother who married two Muslims and whose entire career was devoted to the proposition that the evil American empire was oppressing the poor, oppressed, colonialized people of the Muslim world. In other words, he's not simply a classical 1970s, 1980s style left-wing radical of the garden variety that we see in American universities. He spent a good deal of his childhood in Indonesia. He profoundly identifies with radical Muslims who think that the United States is the cause of all of their problems. And in that sense, I think he's a candidate for the worst president that the United States has ever had, probably the first president of the United States who, in his heart of hearts, believes that the problems of the world should be put at the doorstep of the United States. Even Jimmy Carter, who I think was a dreadful president, did incomparable harm to the United States, still believed in the United States of America in a certain sense. He was the captain of a nuclear submarine. He was a graduate of Annapolis. Obama is a third world pro-Muslim, anti-American radical, and in that sense, he's on the Muslim side against Israel, and it's an extremely dangerous situation for both American security and, of course, for Israeli security, as the video points out.
David, you know, you're absolutely right. I agree 100%. Now, how you're describing Obama, this is what we see with our eyes, despite how he might try to camouflage his agenda. Let me ask this. When you say that, you know, he identifies with radical Islam and all these things, how much is he camouflaging his real agenda? Or, you know, to what extent is it out in the open? To what extent is it he disguising it? Are we going to see a more sinister Obama in the second term if he gets in?
I think it would be extremely dangerous to let him have a second term. The difficulty in evaluating Obama is that because he's such a chameleon, he exposes his true views on many occasions and then turns around and tries to cover them up, which makes him look in a certain way ridiculous. When he went to Cairo, in 2009 and delivered the speech about the glories and wonders of the Muslim world and how America really wants to be friends with Muslims, he really showed his true colors in a number of ways. One way was to completely distort to the point of fantasy the history of the Muslim world. For example, Obama said that Muslims brought the printing press to Europe. That is certainly not true. The Chinese invented the printing press. The Europeans got it from the Chinese. The first printing press was brought to the Muslim world, in fact, Turkey, at the end of the 15th century by exiled Spanish Jews who brought printing presses and printed Hebrew books. The first.
Just a sec. I'm very sorry for interrupting, but this is crucial here to my question and how we're going to pursue this. Is he lying or is he ignorant?
Oh, I think he is. He's not simply ignorant, he's fanatical. He has a construct in his mind. Remember.
But in terms of that particular lie, like that is a historical inaccuracy. Does he know that he is manufacturing a historical inaccuracy?
No, I believe that that there is such a profound personal existential commitment on Obama's part to the success of the Muslim world, mediated by his loyalty to a Muslim father who abandoned him, a Muslim stepfather, an Indonesian stepfather who abandoned him, and a mother who also abandoned him, dumped him with the grandparents while she went out to save the poor craftsmen of Muslim Indonesia from the depredations of the terrible globalized economy. Obama, in his heart of hearts, has such a profound identification with Muslims that he will invent a fantasy, a legend, which corresponds to his impulses and prejudices. So in that sense, I think he's really out of reality in a profound way, and he's surrounded himself by advisors who are equally out of reality. One name that never comes up in the press, or rarely does, is Valerie Jarrett. Valerie Jarrett is his principal advisor, counselor to the president. She's the daughter of a left-wing African-American physician who left the United States in the 1940s and 1950s out of rage against, you know, America's problems and moved to Iran. She was born in Iran, grew up in Iran, and believes profoundly in the validity of Iranian or Persian culture in its opposition to American imperialism and colonialism and so forth. That's his number one advisor. Other advisors, Samantha Power, for example, born in Ireland, profoundly leftist, has called for United Nations intervention, you know, for the UN to send troops in to keep the Israelis under control. Samantha Power runs the Human Rights Desk at National Security Council, effectively runs American foreign policy from the National Security Council. This group that Obama has surrounded himself with are fantasists. They have such a deep emotional connection to the supposedly poor, oppressed colonial peoples of the Muslim world, such a deep antipathy to what they see as imperialist America, that I don't believe they are capable of perceiving the reality that is now unfolding before our eyes in the Muslim world.
Well, what a tragedy that we have these radicals in power. David, you keep referring to the term, to the word abandonment when it comes to Obama. I mean, I've read your book. I've read a lot of your work, even at your at the speech, the fascinating speech you gave in Los Angeles a few weeks ago. It's very clear that you have a very shrewd and profound understanding of human psychology. So let me pick your brain here a little bit in terms of this abandonment. So Obama has, you're saying he was abandoned by a father, a stepfather, etc. How do you think, expand for us a little bit on how this has molded his outlook and his anti-Americanism and his, I guess, he's longing perhaps for the affirmation from an adversarial religion, perhaps?
Obama is a bright child who was abandoned by a father, a stepfather, and a mother. The mother, as I mentioned, dumped him with his grandparents in Hawaii while she went off to complete her PhD in Indonesia after the mother was abandoned by her second husband, Obama's stepfather, in Indonesia. And I believe the experience of this abandonment made Obama all the more eager, number one, to be able to control the adults around him, and secondly, to gain favor from adults who had rejected him by showing all the more loyalty to the causes which they espoused.
I see. So in some ways he could win his father's love by embracing the Muslim Brotherhood, let's
and
say.
And that's completely clear from his own books, from his own autobiographies. In Dreams of My Father, Obama describes at the point where he decided to become a so-called community organizer, which basically means a socialist organizer, going to Chicago, going to the low-income housing projects in Chicago, and feeling that the people of Chicago were much worse off than the poor people of Indonesia. I forget his precise words, but he said in effect that in the marketplace of Indonesia, you find people who spent a whole day gathering firewood to cook their dinner, people who lived on a few pennies a day, who were miserably poor, but nonetheless had a sense of identity and belonging and authenticity by virtue of their adherence to traditional culture and the Muslim religion. And compared to these people in Indonesia with whom he had grown up during his formative years, the poor people of Chicago were alienated, cut off from their identity, were much worse off. So he compared favorably the Muslims of Indonesia to African Americans in Chicago, and he saw in a sense the sense of belonging and religious ideology of the Indonesian Muslims as a positive against the anomie and lack of identity that he perceived in Chicago. That's an incredible statement, to think that Muslims in Indonesia who live on a dollar a day and are miserably poor, beat their wives, are illiterate, live a life of superstition and fear, are somehow better off than Americans. An astonishing statement, but you can read that in Dreams of My Father.
Yeah,
so
pathological.
Nothing that I'm attributing to Obama is absent from his own writings. If you simply look at what he's chosen to present himself to the public, it's all there in black and white. And I find this quite frightening in a president of the United States.
David, what is this Christian dressing that he's put on? How much of it is real? This is all a little bit confusing with the Muslim dynamic. What do you think is going on here?
Well, I'm very cautious about trying to read the mind of someone regarding what his religion is. There are many people who say Obama is a covert Muslim. Mm-hmm. There's no way to read into a man's heart and say what his religion truly is. However, the kind of Christianity that Obama espouses is the Christianity of Jeremiah Wright, which is not the kind of Christianity that most Americans understand by that religion. Jeremiah Wright adheres to a very strange kind of black nationalist Christianity, a school of thought which believes that African Americans are the chosen people as opposed to Israel in the sense of the Jewish people or what the Christian church is considered to be the Israel of the Spirit, the congregation of Jesus Christ, which is an extension of Israel or a spiritualized Israel. Jeremiah Wright believes that the people who are most oppressed are by definition the people of God, and therefore American blacks are the chosen people, which is a very weird kind of Christianity. So to the extent that Obama has adhered to a Christian church, not being able to read into his heart and not wanting to put words into the mouth of anyone regarding religion, nonetheless, as a matter of record, the church that he adhered to practices a brand of Christianity which the vast majority of Americans would consider radically different from what they understand Christianity to be.
also something quite different is sitting in a church for 20 years and maintaining you have no idea what the pastor was saying for two decades, right?
Yes, and there is an interpretation that Obama simply joined Jeremiah Wright's church because it was the most prominent, most politically connected church in Chicago. He did so as a matter of opportunism. Again, I don't presume to be able to look into a man's heart
right.
and say what his faith is, but as a matter of record, if you look at what that church represents, it is not the kind of traditional Christianity which my Christian friends, and I speak, you know, as a believing Jew, not as a Christian, but I did spend some time as an editor of First Things magazine, which is one of the premier Christian magazines in the United States. I think I know something about that, and I believe that what Obama represents or what Obama adhered to has very little to do with the Christianity that most Americans understand by that religion.
Yeah. David, let's get back to this for a minute. If because there's the political journey here and the personal journey, and they intertwine with each other. If you're an abandoned young man, your Muslim father or Muslim stepfather, etc., abandon you, so first of all, you're pretty angry, but to win their favor, to win the favor of Muslims, it makes sense to hate Jews, correct?
Well, you know, this is a difficult question. I don't think Obama is a classical anti-Semite in the way that, say, Ron Paul is a bit of a classical anti-Semite. Obama and his, wants to seek the approval of everybody. But there is a question of where you cut things down the middle. Obama is fanatically, ideologically committed to the idea that the Muslim world is a wonderful place, Muslim civilization is a wonderful thing, and therefore it must be a success. That means, in the case of Egypt, that when the Muslim Brotherhood and parties even more extreme than the Muslim Brotherhood win the majority of congressional, of legislative elections, as they did last month, that the Obama administration takes the position that they have to accept that, and American policy has to adapt to the radical, pro-terrorist, violent, anti-Israel, Jew-hating Muslim Brotherhood, because that represents the will of the Muslims. So if someone comes to you and says, well, your neighbor has the position that he wants to murder you with an axe, we have to take his position at face value, so we're going to find a compromise between your desire to live in peace and your neighbor's desire to murder you with an axe, and we'll split it down the middle. That's not exactly an objective negotiating position, and that's effectively what the Obama administration has done with respect to Israel and the enemies that surround it, which explicitly wish to murder the Israeli population and kill the Jews wherever they can find them.
Mm-hmm. But do you personally see anti-Semitism in Obama? Or again, it's too... Is it...
Obama is not classically anti-Semitic in the sense that he doesn't hate Jews viscerally. He's perfectly happy to have Jews around him. He just appointed Jack Lew, who's an Orthodox Jew,
okay.
as his chief of staff. He had Rahm Emanuel, who was not quite Orthodox, but certainly very closely identified as a Jew, as a chief of staff. He has Hanukkah parties. He'll have something resembling a Passover Seder at the White House. So unlike classical anti-Semites, he is not viscerally opposed to Jews individually. However, his attitude towards the Muslim world puts the United States in the service of Muslim extremists should Muslim extremists come to power.
Right.
The proper American approach to a country dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood is to turn our backs on them. We should not be giving aid, much less military aid, to a country where the majority parties are Islamist extremists who believe that the United States is the great Satan and Israel ought to be destroyed.
Yeah.
We simply shouldn't have anything to do with them. We should walk away from them and do our best to isolate them. Obama has done the opposite and taken the position, which has been widely discussed in the press, that the United States has to open a dialogue with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is completely insane. The State Department said last week we've had assurances from the Muslim Brotherhood that they're going to maintain the peace treaty with Israel should they come to power in Egypt. And the Muslim Brotherhood said, that's not true. We don't like the peace treaty. It wasn't our treaty. We don't want peace with Israel, and we're going to tear it up. And the State Department said, well, you know, but we have had assurances. It's a ridiculous, embarrassing, and humiliating position for the United States to be in. And it all stems, I mean, fish stink from the head. And in this case, the problem begins with Obama's fanatical commitment to Muslim success, no matter what kind of failure the Muslims set up for themselves.
And yes, absolutely. Now, let's just go over for a second some of these disastrous policies. For instance, when we had the Iranian Spring, if we can call it that, Obama does not come to their aid, does not say anything on their behalf. The same when it comes to Syria. But in Libya, we get rid of Gaddafi for no reason in terms of national security importance for the United States. Now the people that are coming to power are going to get their hands on those surface-to-air missiles that we know might be ending up in Gaza now. In Egypt, Mubarak has the rug taken out from under his feet, Muslim Brotherhood coming to power. We've even got Obama. The Obama administration is getting Karadawi, an Islamist, to negotiate for the United States with the Taliban. It looks like the Taliban is being facilitated coming back to power in Afghanistan. It just seems like one tragedy after another. Do you have a comment on some of these developments?
Well, I think that the Obama administration really has lost touch with reality. The reality in Egypt is that even Islamists have to eat. And Egypt is a country which has 45% illiteracy. It has a university system which warehouses something like 10 million young Egyptians, but it can't graduate a single competent engineer, virtually nobody, who comes out of this massive diploma mill run by the Egyptian government, is qualified to be hired by any multinational corporation. So it's simply a form of disguised unemployment. 60% of Egyptians live on the farm, but they still import half their caloric consumption. So, and if you look at the details of Egyptian society, the position of Egyptian women is one of the worst of any country in the world. 90% of Egyptian women undergo a procedure which euphemistically is called female genital mutilation, a clitorectomy. It's a hideous thing. 30% of Egyptians marry first or second cousins, which is to say that Egyptian society is clan-based as opposed to universal or democratic. This is a primitive society. People can't read. They're dependent on their clan, on blood relations, to take care of them. And, of course, the Egyptian economy is in absolute free fall. There have been food riots, people being killed over loaves of bread, reported widely in the press in the last several days. The country's running out of money. They're not paying on contracts and foreign exchange. So this is a country running out of money, which depends on imports for 50% of their caloric consumption. The country is going to go into chaos. And despite all of the administration's efforts to coddle the Muslim Brotherhood and find a modus vivendi and trot them out as newly baked moderates, I think these efforts are going to fail catastrophically, and the result is going to be chaos, bloodshed, a great deal of hunger, and an enormous humiliation, a black eye for the United States. So whatever the administration attempts to do to try to represent these extremist, barbaric elements in Egyptian politics as partners for dialogue with the United States, it will fail utterly and miserably.
David, one thing that you've been stressing is, in your speech also a couple of weeks ago in Los Angeles, you were stressing that if we even have a chance in this terror war and our confrontation with jihadists, that the West has to harden its hearts. its heart, and that Westerners have to harden their hearts. And one of the things you talk about is that we even, you know, we cannot be ashamed or even feel a way about even maybe getting the Muslims to fight amongst each other and all kinds of other things. Can you comment on some of these things?
I don't think it takes a great deal of encouragement for Muslims to fight amongst each other at this point.
Right, but that somewhere we have to become more ruthless in the face of this war, right?
We have a catastrophe of biblical proportions developing in Egypt and several other countries, including Syria, including Libya. These are countries which have populations which are, to a great extent, illiterate. Half of Egyptians live on less than $2 a day, or $600-700 a year. Now, just to give you an idea of how desperate the circumstances are, the cost of wheat, not counting transportation, baking, or anything else, just if you were able to go with a bushel basket to a grain elevator in Canada and buy the wheat at the market price, the cost of the amount of wheat required to give you enough calories to survive for a year is roughly $200.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're making $600 a year, what does it mean if the cost of the calories alone is $200? Egypt is going broke. It can't feed itself. The response is going to be, we've already seen it. We've already seen food riots in a number of towns in Egypt. This will get a great deal worse. Now, the first response of traditional society, where people rely on their immediate clan networks to protect themselves, is to grasp back to primitive tradition all the more tightly. So, of course, you're going to get an Islamist response, because the military governments that have run Egypt since Nasser have kept the population under control by keeping Egyptians illiterate, hungry, down on the farm, and pregnant. So the only thing they have to grasp on is traditional society, so they'll elect Islamists. The United States is in a position where a former ally run by, you know, a sketchy character like Mubarak, who is nonetheless our sketchy character, has gone into an economic tailspin. The population has grasped at the straw of Islamism and elected more than two-thirds of legislators who are bitterly anti-American, bitterly anti-Israeli, pro-violence, and essentially incapable of any dialogue with the United States. The only thing the United States can do is to turn its back on that kind of government. We simply can't negotiate with people like that. It would be the same as negotiating with Osama bin Laden or Ahmadinejad. These are pro-terrorist America haters. But the result of that will probably be that Egypt will start looking like Somalia. You'll have a lot of starvation. You'll have fights over food. You'll have a lot of deaths. And when I say harden our hearts, we have a catastrophe developing in the Muslim world, which we cannot stop, however much we try to do so. If we try to pump foreign aid into Egypt, which I think would be misguided, it'll get stolen anyway, because the military is more concerned at this point with buying townhouses in Chelsea or apartments in the 16th a runny spot in Paris than in protecting their population. This is an African kleptocracy sitting on top of an Islamist popular reaction. So Egypt at this point is really a write-off. We have to walk away from a situation which we've helped inadvertently to worsen over the decades. It's an irredeemable society. There's nothing we can do about it.
In other words, you know, any kind of aid or this kind of Western empathy, or to try to even an Obama-style, let's say, bailout, or, you know, just we have to forget that altogether. And in other words, we have to even turn our backs if masses of people are starving.
That's going to happen in any case, Jamie, because the American Congress, particularly a Congress with a Republican majority, even if the Obama administration were to come before it with a foreign aid package for Egypt, which it has not dared to, Congress wouldn't support it at this point. We've got too many pressing needs at home. We've got a massive deficit, and foreign aid is probably the least popular line item on American budget expenditures. So even if the administration took the position that the United States should mortgage itself further into debt in order to bail out Egypt, it's simply not in the cards. So despite the fantasies of the Obama administration about a wonderful American engagement with this wonderful Islamic culture, which Obama bloviated about in Cairo 3 years ago, this is not going to happen. What we have, in fact, is a catastrophe in our hands. And it's a catastrophe, in my view, that stretches from the Libyan-Algerian border all the way to the Pakistani border with China, involving almost every country in that entire crescent.
And so, David, in other words, this whole talk of the quote-unquote Arab Spring, I think it's time to write up an obituary for it, in the sense that I think it's just beyond reasonable doubt. This is no spring at all. It's an Islamist and chaotic winter, correct?
I agree with you, Jamie. I think we Americans are much too nice. We assume that because in America, people of different faiths and nationalities get along so well, that it is natural for that to happen. We forget the fact that America is populated by people who abandoned the flawed cultures in which they were raised and came to America to get away from the endemic problems of the world. So I think the interpretation of the Arab Spring, both by left and right, was far too optimistic.
Yeah,
we saw things through rose-colored glasses. What we have is not an Arab Spring at all. We have is the convulsions of a dying civilization.
And David, on the like, on the one hand, it's dying, which perhaps is a good thing for the West. On the other hand, the timeline here is very precarious and scary, because this is a catastrophe. We've lost Egypt. You know, we're losing the Middle East to the Islamists gaining power. This is a catastrophe for Israel. Are you worried? Are you frightened for Israel? What may happen now, and what needs to be done? I mean, I think Israel might even have to act alone if Obama remains in power.
Well, the question is what the practical threats are. The economic catastrophe that's overwhelmed Egypt as well as Syria certainly will, over time, drastically degrade the military capability of both countries. If your budget's collapsing, you can't afford spare parts for your tanks and aircraft. So probably the result is that the conventional capacities of Egypt and Syria, as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon, which was, of course, armed and supported by Syria, will deteriorate. So from a purely chessboard objective balance of forces standpoint, Israel's position improves on that count, although when you have a lot of surface-to-air missiles from Libya floating around, the dangers of rocket fire and terrorism and so forth become much greater. So Israel undoubtedly will suffer more successful attacks with higher-quality weaponry from the fanatics in Gaza and elsewhere and Lebanon who have the capacity to throw missiles at it. But these are not existential threats against Israel. The existential threat against Israel is concentrated in one place, and that's Iran.
Mm-hmm.
If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, we're in a world of pain, not just Israel, but all of us, because the Iranian regime really is not much different from the Nazis in the 1940s. A friend of mine likes to say, think of Hitler in the bunker in April of 1945, but instead of a Luger, he's got a nuclear weapon. Would he use it?
Hmm.
The answer, I think the question answers itself. And in the case of the Iranians, you have a leadership with an apocalyptic sense of the imminent death of Persian culture and a sense that this is their last chance to assert their power in the world. They're going hell for leather to try to develop a deliverable nuclear weapon. If they were to do that, it will be used, if not against Israel, against the United States, against an American city, against Saudi Arabia, against someone, and the consequences would be hideous. No matter how much it costs to destroy Iran's capacity to develop a nuclear weapon, and I think the cost might be substantial, it's stupid cheap against the cost of allowing the Iranians to acquire a nuclear weapon.
Absolutely. And David, I know this is, you know, a bit problematic and difficult to answer and to calculate these things, but what do you think in terms of some kind of a preemptive strike that might have to be launched? Does this have to be done within 6 months, a year and a half, or this is kind of the wrong way of thinking about it?
My personal view is that the right time to conduct a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear capacity is yesterday. Why take chances?
By who? By who?
By the United States. The United States should do it. Because if the United States did it, we would be, you know, pretty well assured of wiping out Iran's nuclear capacity. Israel would have a somewhat
more
difficult
time. But
that's
not going to happen under Obama, right?
No, I think it's extremely unlikely. One never says never. Obama's first impulse, of course, is political survival, and it is conceivable that despite all of his ideological prejudices and his profound affinity for the Muslims, I guess it's conceivable that if he thought that doing that would win him the election, for example,
mm-hmm.
it's not to be completely excluded, but I think it's extremely improbable.
Yeah.
I think it's certainly possible that if the Israelis were to come to the conclusion that within a matter of months the Iranians would be able to put a functional nuclear warhead on a long-range missile, that they would in fact take preemptive action on their own, very difficult for me to say. There's an enormous amount of speculation about this. The technological capabilities are difficult to reckon. This is not my area of expertise.
Yeah.
But I have to believe that if the United States doesn't do it, the Israelis at some point would have no choice but to.
And overall, the
action.
Damage that might be done on both sides will be much less if something is not done quickly.
Well, that's exactly correct.
Yeah.
David,
go ahead.
The cost of not preempting this war would be the likelihood that the Iranians would deliver nuclear weapons to terrorists who would use them in American cities.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's hard to be optimistic in these times. David, before we go to the phone lines, one topic that you speak about, there's many topics you speak about that fascinate me, but one in particular, very fascinating. You talk about how, I'm shifting gears here a little bit, how in the Judeo-Christian tradition, in Judaism and Christianity, there's a kind of a concept of the individual, of the individual's relationship with God. In Christianity, people have a relationship with Jesus Christ. In Judaism, there's kind of a dialogue occurring between the individual and his God. And you have shown that in Islam, this dynamic does not exist between individuals and Allah, and that this actually is very important for us to understand, because the consequences manifest themselves in our terror war. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, if you go to Iraq or Egypt or Syria and you tell people, what we want you to do is vote for a representative, and that representative whom you've never met, who's not related to you, you probably never get to talk to this person, is going to go to some city very far away and sit with other representatives and bargain for your interests. And this representative might bargain away your irrigation water or whether your sons go to the military or your taxes and so forth. In most of the world, people will say, you're out of your mind. How can we trust anyone whom we don't know, who isn't married into our clan, who wouldn't be shamed by not following clan interests? We don't understand the idea that you can simply send someone off to a distant city to represent us. It makes no sense at all. What is it that allows Americans or Anglo-Saxons to send representatives off with the confidence that the system will work? It's because we have a belief in the sacredness of the system and the sacredness of individual rights. We trust people in America. At, obviously, we have a certain amount of vigilance. We don't completely trust our politicians, but we have a sense of mutual trust because of the idea, the founding idea of America, that individual rights are holy. They're granted by God, and that we have a national consensus which fosters that. It's a very difficult idea for people in traditional society to accept. We forget how completely extraordinary and unique this American idea is. In the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln wondered whether we'd be able to keep this experiment 87 years after the Revolution. America has kept it, and because of America's success and prestige, a lot of people imitate us. But it's different to have this bread in the bone of our political faith, as it were, and to reproduce this in places where, for example, in Pakistan, 60% of people marry first or second cousins. It's a clan-based society. Relations and loyalties are based on blood, not on faith. And that's the difference.
And David, when you speak about this unprecedented experiment that America is, that the individual, you know, he has a relationship with God, he's given rights by God, this is exceptionalism. This is American exceptionalism. Wasn't it a disgrace? Isn't it a disaster how Obama answered that question about America being exceptional?
Now, that's really the most scurrilous and scrofulous thing that an American president possibly ever has said in all of our history. The whole world knows America is different. America is a country founded on a proposition, the idea that men are created equal and that they are given rights that can't be taken back, inalienable rights by God. That's the idea of covenant, to use the biblical language.
Yeah.
Everyone knows America is different. All the other countries are there because people speak the same language, have the same ethnicity, have a common history. They happen to be there. If Germany is fascist, democratic, communist, or whatever, Buddhist, it's still Germany because they're the Germans. America is not America except for the idea of what America represents. And for Obama to say, I believe in American exceptionalism the way the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism, to deny the fact there's something special about America, which the whole world knows, is a profound insult to the character of America. And it's completely shocking, as you say, Jamie, that an American president would say something like that.
And David, in many respects, I think that Obama hates the idea that we're special, and I think he's going out of his way to make sure that America is no longer special. Am I correct?
I think that's exactly what Obama has said when he went to the United Nations. When he went to the UN General Assembly in September 2009, he said, we don't want American hegemony. We don't want the idea that any country should be hegemonic, which is astonishing because America is the most powerful country in the world, and we cannot pretend that we're not.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing statement.
What a tragedy that this man has been elected to lead such a beautiful and great country. We're going to go to our phone lines. Stephen calling from wintry, cold Toronto, Canada. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Jamie. Good evening, David.
Thanks for calling the show. Are you fighting off the polar bears up there up north?
Yeah, it's a tough goal, but I managed to get to the only phone around, and I wanted to call in. So
okay, you have.
Have a question for David.
Okay.
It's actually a two-part question. The first is, with you're saying Egypt's going to disintegrate into chaos. So are we putting too much emphasis on the Muslim Brotherhood getting into power? Like you said once that even Islamists, in one of your columns, that even Islamists have to eat. And my other question is, you talked about the woman around Obama, but you didn't mention Michelle Obama. I wonder if you could comment on where she fits into the picture in the White House and in President Obama's philosophy in life.
Okay, one second. Let's take one question at a time. Stephen, even for my sake, could you crystallize your first question in a sentence, please?
Okay, the Muslim Brotherhood, everyone seems to be afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood getting into power, but David has said Egypt's going to is on a path of chaos, is going to descend into chaos. So are we putting too much emphasis on what they might be able to do when they get into the power? Aren't they going to have their hands full?
Okay. I think that the Muslim Brotherhood will probably regret the political power that's accrued to it. As I said, Egyptian society is a profoundly traditional society. Half of Egyptians are illiterate, 90% of women are genitally mutilated, a third of Egyptians married first or second cousins. This is a tribal, primitive society with a very thin layer of educated or semi-educated elite on top of it. And given the collapse of their economy in the wake of the revolts starting a year ago, I think Egypt will go into profound chaos, as I said, a catastrophe of biblical proportions. And in a sense, it doesn't matter that much who's nominally in charge. The military is currently nominally in charge, and from what I can tell, the most important thing on the military's agenda is to steal as much money as they can and get it overseas before they're kicked out, too. By default, the Islamist parties will be what's left because they're the only organized force there. They're the only political force which corresponds to the primitive traditional character of Egyptian society, and they will, in fact, lead a miserable and chaotic existence. They'll end up like the Somali warlords.
So there'll be no danger to Israel then, you think, the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, they'll be dangerous in the sense that Sana'a will be crawling with terrorists, and Hamas will get a lot of weapons. And Hamas will have more ability to fire more sophisticated missiles at Israel, and a lot of Israeli people will die as a result. But when I say a lot, it's dozens, it's not tens of thousands. It's not an existential threat. It's a serious threat, but not one that will ultimately decide whether the state of Israel lives or dies. I think Egypt will, in fact, go into chaos, and it has mixed results for Israel. It's an enormous annoyance. That may be the wrong word to describe a circumstance in which, you know, a significant number of people lose their lives. But in terms of the fighting capacity of the Egyptian military, it seems inevitable that this will be drastically degraded. So the prospective conventional threat to Israel coming from Egypt will diminish.
Well, that's what I meant. You don't see a 1973 war again coming from the Muslim Brotherhood attack.
No, it's out of the question because the 1973 war was run by the Russians. It's part of the Cold War. They had Russian advisors. They had Russian pilots flying Egyptian planes. They had Russian armaments. There's no possibility that the Egyptians would be able to mount that kind of threat. One of the wonderful things about winning the Cold War and destroying the evil Soviet Empire is that you don't have the Russians using the Egyptian army as their cat's paw against Israel, as against an American ally. So in that sense, a world without the Russian Empire is a great deal safer than it was before the end of the Cold War. The Russians are still spoilers. They can do any number of annoying things. They could give surface-to-air missiles, which they make some very good ones, to Israel's enemies. But I don't think it's at all comparable to 1973. I think that the security threat is much more manageable, even though it's going to be, you know, tragically disruptive on the small scale. But I think that most Israeli strategists believe that the degradation of conventional capabilities, both of Egypt and Syria, means that Israel's relative position will probably improve.
Well, I got to go to another call soon. Steve, ask your second question about Michelle Obama.
I just was interested in David's opinion on what he thinks of Michelle Obama and how she fits into his philosophical outlook.
Michelle Obama's profile, if you read, for example, her undergraduate thesis at Princeton, which is on the internet, which I've written about, she's basically a black nationalist radical in her youth. Since the election, Michelle Obama has been kept very much under wraps. They've kept her sort of the crazy aunt in the closet at the White House and haven't let her say anything about politics. So it's very difficult to guess what she currently thinks at the moment. One can make what one wants of the public record of her previous views, but you can't necessarily blame a woman in her 40s for things that she said when she was 20. So We really don't know. We know that Michelle Obama during the campaign said some very unpleasant things about the United States and expressed her rage against the United States, but the Obama administration has wisely kept her out of the limelight. So we really don't know enough about her. I hope we never find out.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for calling. We are going to go to Atlanta, Georgia, an individual by the name of Mark is phoning. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jamie.
Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. David, I'm wondering, given the psychological underpinnings that you mentioned earlier in the conversation, stemming from Obama's abandonment, do you feel that his antipathy, his clear antipathy toward the American exceptionalism in general, stems more from that sense of estrangement, so to speak, or and his desire to get back in the good graces of these people that he feels he's lost the favor of? Or do you think that the influence of these Marxist mentors that he's been surrounded with his entire life have held more sway in terms of the reason why he feels the way he does, that the Constitution is a charter of negative rights, so to speak?
I don't think that these are necessarily different things. Of course, Obama's mentor as a young man was an African-American Communist Party member named Frank Marshall, who guided him as a young man. His mother was a communist fellow traveler. But the third world anti-colonial milieu, which he grew up in because his mother brought him into that milieu by marrying first an African Muslim Marxist and then an Indonesian Muslim Marxist, is exactly what the Russian Empire was promoting during the 1970s and 1980s as their principal instrument against the United States. Two, three, many Vietnams. The anti-colonial struggle was supposed to be the great vehicle for destroying American power. It's very tricky to put Obama on the couch and to make these fine distinctions. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't trust the psychiatric profession in general. When I speak about these things, I refer precisely to what Obama himself has said in black and white. And the decisive statements from Obama's standpoint are that he identifies with the authenticity and integrity of life as he sees it in Muslim countries and their traditions and their sense of belonging, collective identity, and he considers that superior to the moral confusion and anomie of poor people in the United States. That's an astonishing statement. That's in Dreams of My Father. It's in print. So based on the public record, as Obama himself has told it to us, one doesn't have to make fine psychological distinctions to come to a conclusion, because this is how Obama himself has chosen to represent himself to the American public. I find that frightening.
Thank you. And Mark, thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you, Jamie.
David, we have a few minutes left. I have to say that the second part of your title in your book, How Civilizations Die and Why Islam is Dying Too, that second part gave me a great night's sleep, and it kind of cheers me up a little bit.
Well, you know,
can you tell us a little bit about that Islam is dying? Because, you know, as you know, the main belief in our culture and society is that it's the opposite.
The globalized world has raised the threshold for everybody. We have, you know, two-thirds of the world's population is in the midst of the greatest economic transition in all of history. People are leaving rural poverty for urban prosperity. People who grew up with dirt floors, no health care, and open sewers now live in houses with real floors and running water and working toilets and electricity. 20 million people in China leave the countryside to come to the cities. This is two-thirds of the world. And you have a new generation of people coming out of Asia, you know, enormous amounts of talent being educated. Now, the Muslim world has not a single university that functions outside of Turkey, which has a couple of universities, but Turkey is a country where not even one quarter of kids manage to graduate high school. Large parts of the Muslim world, like Egypt and Pakistan, are 50% illiterate. These are cultures which simply cannot compete in this dynamic and changing world, and the self-awareness of these cultures that they are failures, they're not functioning, they can't make it, there's something wrong with them, is leading to extreme social pathologies. And in cases where you have highly educated populations like Iran, Muslims have simply stopped having children. It's not widely known, but as I point out in my book, How Civilizations Die, Iran has the same low fertility rate as Europe. And you know, many of your listeners have read books by Bhatt-Yur or Mark Stein or George Weigel or myself describing the demographic winter in Europe. But that demographic winter has already hit all of the educated countries in the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done so at a speed which we've never seen before in history. These are dying civilizations. The risk is that as they die, I mean, again, think of Hitler in the bunker with a nuclear weapon.
Right.
They'll take a great many of us with them, too. So
mm-hmm.
over the long term, I don't think Islam is really a threat. It's a dying culture, and it's certainly much less dangerous than the evil Soviet Empire was. That was very scary. Russia was a great country that produced brilliant people and had enough nuclear weapons to vaporize the world.
But
it's not true with the Muslim world.
Okay, wait 1 second. David, try to keep your answers a little bit briefer in these last remaining minutes so I can
sure.
touch on a few things here. Wait a minute. Did you say that during the Cold War against the Soviet Union, it was a more dangerous time than right now against
Absolutely.
Islam?
Absolutely. The Russians were a more dangerous enemy.
Well, wait a minute, David. The communists at least were interested in self-preservation. In terms of Muslims, we're dealing with a lot of these people who are not interested, like Ahmadinejad, in self-preservation.
That's true, Jamie. But if the United States decided to preemptively act against Iran, we could swat them like a fly. It would
mm-hmm.
not be difficult.
Right.
Dealing with the Russians militarily was a much more difficult task.
Okay, so in terms of their ability to strike back, right?
Yeah, if we had the will to suppress
mm-hmm.
the threats of the United States coming out of Iran and other places, we
mm-hmm.
could neutralize those threats very quickly.
David, the discussion began with Obama. Let's end with Obama. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to the best of my memory, in our last radio interview, you said that Obama was a sociopath. Am I correct?
When I say sociopath, I mean that literally in the sense of someone who has no sense of conscience about lying. Obama
uh-huh.
has misrepresented himself to the American public in order to get power.
Mm-hmm.
And lies easily, convincingly, with no conscience at all. He's a very dangerous person in that respect. So
uh-huh.
I think the characterization sociopath is exactly correct.
So this is a man with no conscience in the White House.
That's correct.
And I mean, this is a great departure, because I think no matter what we thought of George Bush, you could say that on many respects he was an ethical man, he was a truly religious man, and he did have a conscience. Would we agree on that?
Absolutely. George Bush
right.
was a good human being. I agreed with some things
right.
he did. I disagreed with other things that he did, but there was no question about his sincerity. Obama right. has become the leader of a country which he considers to be the main source of problems in the world. He could not get elected by saying that explicitly, though, in fact, if you read carefully, not even carefully, simply read what he said, that comes out of his writings. And it's
yeah.
a source of astonishment to me that the American public had the poor judgment to elect a president who really doesn't like them at all.
Yeah, David Goldman, we have run out of time. It was such an honor and privilege to speak with you.
Jamie, my privilege entirely. Thanks so much.
And to hear all of your wisdom. Thank you, and I hope you'll come on again soon, okay?
It'll be my privilege. Thank you so
much. Thank you very much. And to all our listeners, get David Goldman's book, How Civilizations Die and Why Islam is Dying Too. We'll see you next week.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.